Ah, mmm. The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. Are we human? Do sheep dream? It's raining in Los Angeles, cars are flying, and the owl is mechanical. As we talk Blade Runner on this week's episode of Zach on Film.
Okay, the plural of sheep is sheep.
Whatever. Can't change it now. It's recorded to tape.
Zach, did you even listen to last week's episode where we talked about technology and we don't record anything on tape again? Good Lord.
Oh, but no, that was all visual. We're still on audio tape here at Major Spoilers.
I don't know about tape. Yeah.
If you've ever seen the Adam West Batman, like what the Bat Computer looks like, yeah. That's actually what our recording setup looks like.
Actually, all punch card based.
Yeah. We've been really influenced by like Jack White's setup at his house with his all analog recording. We're like, we're taking podcasting analog.
Yeah. Gonna send
old
out,
school.
We're gonna send out wax cylinders to people.
Yeah.
Wait. Buy Jack Black.
You can buy this week's Zach on Film episode on vinyl.
I've heard of Barry White.
So Zach, Blade Runner.
Yeah.
It's a Philip K. Dick story.
Yes.
Based on a Philip K. Dick story, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Yep.
Right? And I understand that you read the book.
I did.
Before you watched the movie?
Before.
So give us a breakdown. Let's give us a breakdown of the book first.
Okay. So we have... our main character, Drucker, who is a bounty hunter in San Francisco in the year 2021.
That's just right around the corner.
Point of contention. Originally, when I wrote the book, it was 1991.
Yes.
But then the movie set it farther in the future, so they changed the book. Anyways, doesn't matter.
1991.
So he's a second string bounty hunter for San Francisco with one bounty hunter in front of him. This bounty hunter gets taken out by an android, a Nexus 6 type android,
mm-hmm.
on Earth,
mm-hmm.
and Drucker must now go and take over this case of hunting down these 6 remaining androids and eliminate them. And then, as the story goes on, as he finds the androids, he's confronted with thoughts of, am I an android, or what makes something human, and what is life? And
what is life? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me. No more.
Beautiful poem. It's a big... the Earth has been destroyed by nuclear war, and most of the population is now living on Mars in a colony,
right.
Where most androids are used as a slave labor, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not really supposed... they can be on Earth, but they're supposed to be doing work-type things. They're not allowed
terraforming.
They're not allowed to work amongst the humans... perpetrate themselves as humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when he has to administer a test to find out if they're androids or humans. And if they're android, he eliminates them. And he's confronted with the continuing moral dilemma eventually of not wanting to do these to the androids, because these new version of androids are becoming so sophisticated they almost can fool the Voight-Kampff test that they've been using.
It's the new Jelly Bean version.
Yeah. And so these androids can learn emotions and essentially can act and become humans. And they're actually, some of them are implanted with memories, so they actually believe they are human. But there's also crazy entertainment, a television guy that's essentially on the radio and television all the time.
Right.
And controlling people, kind of. And there's also a religion called Mercenism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which teaches essentially people empathy, because that's the one defining trait between humans and androids, is that androids have a hard time feeling empathy.
So there are a number of books. Philip K. Dick, just really a very influential sci-fi writer.
Yeah, sure.
Prolific.
Very prolific as well. But a number of his books have been translated to screen. Second Variety was transformed into Screamers. Paycheck was transformed into Paycheck in 2003. John Woo directed that. The Golden Man was transformed into the movie Next. The Adjustment Team was turned into the Adjustment Bureau. That came out just a few years ago with...
I didn't know Dick wrote
Tom
that.
Cruise.
Ooh. No, not Tom Cruise. That was Matt Damon in that one. Oh. The Minority Report was the Minority Report. That's the one with Tom Cruise. Directed by Steven Spielberg. We Can Remember It For You Wholesale became Total Recall. Then, of course, we have Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which is Blade Runner. Confessions of a Crap Artist, which was Confessions of a Banjo. Radio Free, what is that? Albemuth became...
Albemuth.
And then A Scanner Darkly was A Scanner Darkly with Keanu Reeves in that.
And Robert Downey Jr.
And Winona Ryder.
That was actually, you know, that was a really good movie. I mean, a lot of people look at that and just like, it is... At. Makes no sense, and it's...
people complain about the animation
stuff. Well, that's the Richard Linklater did that one, and so he had done that previously in a movie and was doing that same kind of weirdness with it. Mm-hmm. But it's if you make it all the way to the end of that movie, suddenly there's this huge revelation that you're like, oh my God, this is wonderful.
I really enjoyed it.
The one thing that you may have noticed as you watched the movie Blade Runner, though, Zach, is that most Philip K. Dick books... don't translate into the same story that you see on the screen.
Certainly not. And as I finished Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, because after...
I should also point out that there's a word-for-word comic book adaptation that Boom Studios put out. It's 36 issues long.
That's cool.
That they just took the words, Philip K. Dick's words, and then lots of text boxes, and then they just illustrated it. So you might want to check that out, too. I can send that along to you.
I know, as I was reading Dick's novel... when I got to the point when the last android is put down, I mean, they're still...
Not called Roy Batty in the book, is he?
No. Nope. He is not.
He's called, what's his face?
Yeah, which is really hard to pronounce.
Something Batty, I think, isn't it? Or Bates. Bates. Bates is his last name. But there's still, after he kills Bates in the book, there's still like 20 pages left. And I was like, if they do this ending... oh man!
So how did
that would have been awesome?
How did it end in the
spoilers?
Yeah, this is a big spoiler.
Yeah, probably.
How did it end in the book? Fill us in.
The book ends with Drucker finishing his job, eliminating the androids, and he had a feud with Rachel before he did this last one because she slept with him in hopes of him not going after the androids because she is also an android. That didn't work on him. He goes and does his job. She goes to his apartment and kills the goat he had just bought.
Mm-hmm.
And so, this is not addressed in the movie Blade Runner. It's a very big part of the book that most of the animal life on Earth is now gone due to these wars. And having an animal is a status symbol, a huge status symbol. And if you can't afford a real animal, because most of them are extinct, you get a fake electric animal, and Drucker has had a electronic sheep.
Right. And they kind of touch on that in the movie because you see
there is,
when he goes down to the marketplace where he goes down to see all the droid builders in the marketplace, you see all those animals around.
Right.
And that's
kind
of touching
owl,
on that.
And there's
right.
the owl, which was in the book.
Right.
But she goes and kills his goat, which he had just bought with the 3,000 he killed from killing the first three androids. Mm-hmm. And he went and bought this insanely priced goat, and she went and killed it, knowing... that was his, like, big thing. He then, feeling horrible about everything, because he had this moral dilemma of killing androids, flies in his vehicle to the border of Oregon, and eventually comes one with Mercer, and with the religious symbol, who is actually proven fake, and then there's this whole religious element of, do you believe what your beliefs are, even if your religion is fake or whatever.
Right.
I've read the book and this is confusing as hell.
The book is confusing and then it ends with him going to bed.
But you forgot about the frog.
Oh, yeah, he finds a frog.
Yeah, yeah. A real frog.
No, it's not real.
He thinks it's a real frog.
He thinks it's a real frog. It's the last one.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fake.
It's a fake frog.
And then he goes to bed. Yeah, then he goes to bed. Which almost kind of ended the movie in the first draft of the script.
With a turtle. So we are watching the 30th anniversary version of this movie, also known as the final cut of this movie.
Yeah.
Right. And I watched this a couple of weeks ago, and I tweeted out, I am so jealous of you being able to watch this movie as the first time you've ever seen anything with Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's like three or four different versions of this movie that have been released previously. Seems like every 5 years or every 7 years they were releasing a version. And the final cut, as a true final cut, if that's really what it's going to be, I think of all the versions of the film, this is the best version of the film.
And from what I understand...
And that goes into... Go ahead.
No, from what I understand, the theatrical version had a lot of voiceover narration.
Yeah, we'll talk about that
in
just
in a, which I think cutting that...
Well, we can get into it later,
so, but I think it's...
Yeah, well, let's just talk about that real quick right now. So in the original release, the studio... And again, this is the problem when you have... people who think they know what they're doing, and they think that because they're the head of the studio, they understand every genre and everything that goes on. And so they want to have their hands in everything. And they watch, and they were confused, and they really just said, we need to have this voiceover done. And Ridley Scott didn't want to do it. Harrison Ford didn't want to do it. In fact, his voiceover was recorded while he was extremely pissed. I mean, he is angry while he's doing this voiceover. And it's slapped on top of the movie. And, you know, for the first time that I ever saw the movie, I remember my dad went to go to the theater to see this by himself. Mom stayed at home with me and my sister, and he came back and was trying to tell this story, and he was like, it's really weird, and it's really kind of fascinating, and all this stuff. And I was just listening to him tell the story. He said, someday I'm going to watch this movie. And then when I watched it, I was like, oh, yeah, this is really cool. This is really neat. And I always thought that, you know, the voiceover is... okay, but it doesn't seem to fit right. And it's because it was slapped on afterwards. And there's this weird kind of thought process that goes on is movies that have a voiceover tend to be not very good movies.
Hmm.
Because you have to add that voiceover on as a way of explaining to the audience what's going on the screen. And I think in the case of Blade Runner, the voiceover hurt the movie, but that was in the original draft of the original release of the movie had the Harrison Ford voiceover. What were you going to say, Matthew?
I can tell you something. In 1983, my next door neighbor had HBO, and this was kind of a status symbol when you're 12 in the 80s. And one of the movies that we saw was that cut of Blade Runner with the voiceover and the Wayne and the Glavin. And I will tell you right now, I watched it when I was 12 or 13, hated it, hated every inch of this movie back to front. And part of that was because of the way that voiceover felt like it was kind of dragging me through things. Like if you read a comic book, you'll see you don't want a comic book where the panel says, and then Rodrigo leapt from his chair, and then you see the picture is Rodrigo leaping from his chair with a thought bubble that says, now I shall leap from my chair.
But
that's the way it felt.
And I don't like the voiceover. I don't like the voiceover. But in defense of the voiceover, if you think about a detective tale, oftentimes you have that voiceover going from it. Well, in the detective movies where you have that voiceover, it's usually the cheesy purple prose detective story. So, I mean, this is kind of how it came across. There was also a different ending in one of the releases where he and Rachel end up flying off, and there's this whole scene where they're flying up through the Oregon or Northern California, the northern part of the country, and he's explaining how they escaped and hoping that what's-his-face, the other cop, Edward James Olmos wasn't going to follow them.
Gaff.
Yeah. But that's all removed from this.
Yeah.
Right.
There are
and
some
that footage
things
was actually from an entirely different movie.
There are some things that are added. No, the unicorn is from a different movie. Them driving north is from that. They had to go back and shoot that. The unicorn sequence was almost taken out. In fact, I think in the first release of the movie, it didn't have the unicorn bit in there. But in the final draft, there's that scene where Harrison Ford's at the piano and he just kind of has this flash of this horse or unicorn running through the forest. And you're like, oh, that's an interesting, makes no sense bit, until you get to the end of the movie and he's leaving and they see the little unicorn origami that Edward James almost left behind. And this was really the, I mean, you kind of brought it up already, but this is the big thing in the story that still has people talking today of, in the movie, is Deckard a replicant or is he a real human?
Right.
And there are some things that have also changed in this release too, because there are at least in the videotape versions that I had, there's at least three instances where Harrison Ford's eyes flash red,
right,
like Rachel's do whenever she's in the low light, that people are like, look, that proves that he's a replicant. And then, of course, with the unicorn on the origami, it makes you believe that Edward James Olmos's character has the printout sheet and knows what memories he has implanted. Yeah. And it's really kind of a fascinating discussion of whether he's really a replicant or isn't he. Rodrigo, is he a replicant or isn't he?
I think it's more compelling if he is. But I think he doesn't have to be in order for the story to be interesting.
Right.
I think, you know, when we get to the end of it, he's already asked all the important questions. You know, it's like, what doth life? What is I'm human?
Right.
What's this life for?
Yes. Is this the real life?
Is this just fantasy?
Right.
What's this thing called love? No, what's this thing called love? Sorry, I get those confused.
To me, it's not terribly important. I mean, it's the sort of thing where it's like, oh, yeah, there's all these things that point to him being one. Mm-hmm. But there's also, you know, it's like also they could just mean nothing. And just the important thing is that the replicants themselves throw into question what it's like to be what it means to be human.
Right.
So whether he turns out to be a replicant or not, you know that he's already thinking about that. And in the end, you know, the decision that he makes is kind of, yes, it does make you human because he wants to end up with Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And also, he is not, unlike the replicants, the Nexus, what are they, sevens or
Nexus
sixes,
sixes. Nexus
in
sixes,
the movie?
Yeah.
They want to know what their end date is. And as a human, you don't know what your end date is, right? And so he doesn't want to find out any of that stuff, if he is indeed. But I think it's that seed of doubt, which is planted in the audience's mind, which is one of the reasons why this movie has lasted so long.
Mm-hmm.
When this movie originally came out, it was almost like Man of Steel. It's like almost a 50-50 split where half the critics and audiences hated this movie and half of the people loved this movie. In fact, it didn't in its initial release make back its box office numbers.
Oh, wow.
I think it only made, I'd have to go back and look. I think it was budgeted at like $25 million. It made $22 million or something like that in the box office.
I am in no way surprised by that.
And you're right. I mean, it's from that standpoint with the movie that was released in theaters. If you compare this final version with the theatrical version is inferior on all counts.
I think it's more awkward. But I think that they both have one important thing right, in that the question being asked is an existential question. And so answering that question in the film is completely antithetical to the nature of the question. So I feel like the original, the 82 version that I saw, kind of pushed you a little more in the direction of maybe he's not. And the final cut version feels like maybe he is, but they both have that, and maybe you're missing something kind of feel to
right.
it. So,
I think one of the most interesting things that bits of pointing to he is an android is he never finds all of the right amount of androids that they're supposed to be, and that he is.
Yeah, he's the sixth. That's what a lot of people say, that he's the sixth. There were a couple of other things too that that people point to that in the theater.
There's actually a really good analysis of architecture and why he is an android if you watch it on Vimeo.
Well, Oh, yeah. Okay, so we'll post that.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, is the androids don't really display a lot of emotion.
No.
And Deckard doesn't express emotion in this movie.
No.
I mean, he expresses the reaction of pain when he's getting his fingers crushed, but you don't see him laugh. You don't see him smile. Anytime anybody's cracking a joke, you don't see him really react except for that very stoic Harrison Ford type face.
And there's precedent for the androids not just displaying affection, but displaying affection for each other.
Right.
Right.
Right. And most importantly, the actual humans, the characters that we know are 100% human. And I don't know if this is intentional. I like to believe it is. All of the absolutely human characters are very amplified in their peccadillos and their flaws and their emotions to the point where, you know, Larry Darryl and his situation, every word out of his mouth is clearly the word of a human being who is very, very, you know, emotionally closed off and immature and, you know, whatever you want to call that. But I feel like when we see a character who is clearly and absolutely human, they actually really work to make sure we know that, yes, they have feelings and they do this and they, you know, we see the one character nearly getting ready for bed. And then, of course, bad things happen to him.
So why not adapt the book, Zach? That's what I was really going to get into originally, was this thing about adaptation and why we ended up with so many different versions of this film. We've talked adaptation before, right, Rodrigo?
On Zach on Film?
Well, maybe not Zach on Film, but we've talked about adaptations from one medium into another.
Oh, sure,
before.
If you listen to the Major Spoilers podcast, we talk about adaptations all the time because comic book movies have become really popular.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked at length about adaptation.
And you want to bring anything to the conversation here?
Yes. Adaptation is great. No. I mean, when you look at an adaptation, there are so many factors and so many people involved in the process that the odds of you getting anything that is similar to the original are actually really slim.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many things that end up changing because people are like, well, this is too long or too short, or this is not going to make sense within the 100,000 minutes that this movie seems to last. It's a little long. I think Blade Runner's a little long. But
love that. 30 years old or 30 years long?
But there are so many steps along the way where things get changed or moved. You know, you have writers, you have directors, you have producers, and there's just this cycle going back and forward where you talk about a movie adaptation where they look at it, they change something, the script gets sent back, and by the end, it may not resemble the original at all.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it may be too difficult to translate something that's done into narration on the screen. It may be too difficult to take a high concept like what a lot of what Dick's stories are and bring them down to a mass audience and make it a mass appeal topic. In the case of so many different versions of this film, you know, there was the theatrical cut, then you had a director's cut, then you had a 10th anniversary release, and then you had the final cut or the 20th anniversary work print. Yeah.
And then the final cut pro.
But, you know, there's this urge and this need to try to fix things.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you have ever done this where you've done a piece, you've turned it in because you were on a timeline or a deadline, and then suddenly you go back and look at it 5 years later and you say, man, I wish I could just go in and actually tweak this. Or do you actually go back in and tweak them, even though it's not being used again?
No, because they're my school film projects, so I don't go back and reshoot anything, but I watch them and like, do you not understand lighting? The answer is no.
For your own personal satisfaction, do you go in and say,
no, for my own personal
let me go in and just tighten this edit up just a little bit, just to see, just for my own personal satisfaction?
No, I never have.
Okay.
Never have.
Some directors are that way, and certainly when you look at Blade Runner, that's where you can really see the cases. I'm not really comfortable with how this turned out, and of course, the director's cut that was released was not really the director's cut.
Yeah.
But you get this eternal meddling to try to make it better, and a lot of people, I mean, a good example is George Lucas is constantly meddling with his films.
Example. I think Ridley Scott going back and releasing this final cut is a lot different than George Lucas going back and changing Star Wars. Because Lucas was not happy, or at least saw technology advances, like, oh, I can make these effects look better now because our computers are faster and I can go in and change this and it'll look aesthetically better. He didn't go in and really change the story besides Han, which, major, minor plot point, debate that, whatever. I think Ridley
also
went
Harrison
in,
Ford.
Yeah, Ridley, right. Ridley, he released the final cut in 2007,
mm-hmm.
which he could have went back and made those flying cars look crazy and awesome and all these cool special effects he could have done to change
Except
the city, expand the city.
We'll talk about that.
He could have expanded
half.
The city more and yeah. stuff, but what he went back and did is took out the parts that he, I think, creatively did not want to put him into narration and things. I think it allowed him to creatively change things to tell a story that I felt, having not watched theatrical, just understanding it and what the changes are, make a story more representative of the Dick novel.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think the cutting out of the voiceover allowed for a greater immersion in the world of Blade Runner.
And there's a lot of tightening up of elements, too. I mean, Matthew says, oh, this is a long movie. It's actually a lot. It's shorter,
than I thought it was.
Theatrical.
It's like 158 or something.
Yeah.
So
you also
short.
Have to look at Electric Sheep as a story is designed to be read by a single person at a single time and digested mm-hmm. at your own speed and your own pace. And there's a lot of, for lack of a better word, navel gazing in that story that really would not make for exciting film, that wouldn't make for a movie experience, because, you know, Deckard flipping out in the desert and seeing a hop toad.
Yeah.
While that could be a really wonderful epiphany moment, and I'm not saying that somebody couldn't make an incredible movie out of that.
Hey, you want to know how the original script ended?
How?
The original script ends, kill the androids. Rachel jumps off of his building committing suicide.
Right.
He is so emotionally wrecked, walks out into the desert until he can't walk any farther, falls down on his face, looks up, and there's a turtle on its back.
Mm-hmm.
And the turtle flips over on its own power. It begins to walk off into the sun, and then he stands up and starts walking back to Los Angeles.
Now, was that also a void comp question in the book?
Yes, it's in the movie.
Well, it's in the movie.
You come over. Oh,
it's in the movie, but isn't in the book as one of the questions.
I think it might be, because I remember when they read it on screen, I remember it sounded really familiar.
Yeah, yeah.
It was the whole flipping the turtle onto its back thing.
It's been forever since I read the book. It's probably been...
And I actually really... When I read that
30 years.
Film noir, I was like, that would have been awesome.
Yeah, so...
But they didn't do it.
So, did you like the movie?
Yes.
How come? What struck you as this movie is good?
This movie is good because it sucked me into the world of Blade Runner, and I have an example of why this is happening. So Blade Runner, and we'll get into this later in editing, is fairly slow. There's a lot of long cuts with very cool soundtrack music.
Vangelis or...
Yeah. So I'm watching this late Friday or something, Saturday, and I stopped about 50 minutes in, because I thought I'd fallen asleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I don't want to fall asleep. I'll just rewatch anyway. So I go to bed. Wake up in the morning, I start watching it again. And I realize I didn't have, actually, because I remembered everything up to the point. Like, I never actually fallen asleep. I'd just been, like, weirdly sucked into these long cut scenes of the city and the music.
You were lulled.
And I just wasn't, like, in the world of Earth. I was like in the weird world of Blade Runner.
Well,
it was happened when I read the book too, because I was reading it at like 4 in the afternoon,
yeah.
And it gets to a part where it's night. I was like, man, it's really late here. It's gotta be like 10:30. Like my clock is like, no, it was like 4:30. It's like, wow, I got really sucked in.
Well, here's one of the interesting things. I mean, Ridley Scott is just coming off Alien,
yeah,
and just people are wanting to throw whatever projects at him, and so he picks up and wants to go with Blade Runner. And what he does with Blade Runner, which I think is so fascinating, is that the reason why you get sucked into this world is because he's exact on microscopic scale as far as detail that goes into this movie. Yes, you do get the broad vista, giant pyramid towers of the Tyrell Corporation. But when you're on the streets are dirty.
Mm.
When you go up onto the roof, the trash is where the trash needs to be in that world. The puddles are puddled where they need to be. the windmills are there. I mean, there's not, it's almost like the detail is, no detail has been overlooked in creating this world. And I think that's why it's so believable.
Oh, agreed.
Even though in the movie it's 2019,
yeah,
November, and boy, we're in big trouble if we haven't invented androids by now, and it's 2019,
yeah, we're not
going to
get there.
The corner. So I think that's one of the things that really draws you in about this world is the exactness of the detail that is put into this movie. I mean, when they're running around in the building at the end, I mean, that feels like a building that's been abandoned for 50 years.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, that's what I think sells this movie,
mm-hmm,
right? I mean, it's a lot different than Deckard, instead of walking around in a trench coat and whatever, as opposed to just walking around in flip-flops and a tank top and making you believe that he's supposed to be this detective. You're brought into that world, and the world is fully realized the minute that you see the first shot on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that's really important. The other thing that makes this world, I think, work is that, and it's the title of a book that I recommended for you to read, is that we're taking a noir tale,
mm-hmm,
and instead of setting it in the 40s, like we've seen other noir tales before, like when we talked about Maltese Falcon,
mm-hmm,
what we're doing is we're setting it into the future. So we get a future take, or we get a modern take of a noir tale that's not told from a traditionalist standpoint, even though everything in this film is done from a traditionalist standpoint. I mean, the dark shadows.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many times do we see the light coming through the window and we're either seeing part of the shade cutting off the face, or we've got the Venetian blind effect going on?
Pretty
or,
sure that's every scene.
Yeah, every scene is just steeped in this is noir, and this is the way we're doing noir. And to be honest with you, in this remastering of this, the blacks are black.
Mm-hmm.
They're not washed out like the VHS and the DVDs that I had from years ago.
You have to adjust the tracking.
Yeah, that was the worst part. But I mean, the blacks are black, and there are some moments in there where I'm looking at this and it just clicks in my mind of, this is what this film should have been like.
Yeah, but by setting it that, you know, that 20 minutes into the future, there are visual elements that are still very retro.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because if you look at, what is her name? Sean Young's haircut is very,
very
Betty Page, 1945.
Yeah, yeah.
And the abandoned building that looks abandoned looks like a building from, you know, the 40s and the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
The things that we see, the things that we run into, have all of Deckard's wardrobe is futuristic, but futuristic in a way that evokes the, you know, the Maltese Falcon, Humphrey Bogart movies that we know.
Retrofitted everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, they give you the visual cues that your brain is like, okay, I'm reading this and I'm feeling this in the, you know, the same way that I have seen these elements played in different stories in different places. But by putting it in the future, they actually take out that worry of when does it take place.
Right.
And it kind of feels like a future and the past all at once.
Yeah.
More ambiguity.
They actually shot it on the Maltese Falcon set.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Yeah,
that's cool.
They took it and they just threw all the
I do have one thing to say about Ridley Scott's cinematography.
What's that?
And Steven and Rodrigo and I have been doing a podcast together now for about 520 episodes,
mm-hmm,
probably 6 years. And over that time, we have nudged and needled and played with each other and gone, ha ha, you're bald, ha ha, you're fat. And then we're like, oh yeah, Rodrigo's just goddamn delightful. But
my mother thinks so.
After watching the 345-minute cut of Blade Runner, I want to tell the two of you, my friends, my compatriots, my colleagues, that I don't ever want to hear a single goddamn joke about my lens flares ever again.
Oh, I'll make all the jokes I want.
At no point going forward are any of us allowed to make fun of my lens flares, because the answer is Blade Runner.
No, there's a difference, and there really is a difference in what
Blade
a lens
Runner.
Flare is and what Matthew does with lens flares,
mm-hmm,
right? A lens flare is a mistake or a flaw of light entering the lens. And when we look at a lens, it's composed of many different elements. So when you have light entering a lens at a particular angle, it will bounce and reflect and refract and do all sorts of things inside. And so you will get those light streaks. With many cheesy light flare effects, you will see them just helter skelter everywhere with no real purpose or point.
Motivation.
With no real motivation. When you shoot with a 35 millimeter prime lens,
that's where you end up with these brilliant blue streaks yeah. of light. And it's very beautiful in that case with a mm-hmm. lens flare. And there are some ways that you can mimic those kinds of lens flares on the screen. So, yes, Matthew, when we talk about lens flares, there are motivated lens flares and things that come naturally from the light entering that lens. And then there are people who really careful. Just think that it's okay to just throw a lens flare anywhere. And I'm talking about...
I'm just talking about post-production
where people are just like, well, let's put a lens flare mm-hmm. here and let's put a lens flare here. And every light bulb and every candle has to have a lens flare. And they're really not thinking when they're creating the lens flare, why is that lens flare being created? They're just like, oh, let's just put a lens flare there. And a lot of people fall into this mistake.
So tell me why there's a lens flare in 80% of the scenes in this film.
I think
there's a lens flare in 80% of the scenes in this film because we are replicants too. And we are seeing the light as interpreted through the lens. That really is what Ridley Scott flares. Is telling us with his use of lens flare.
Yeah, there really aren't that many as there aren't as many lens flares.
Film
as
degree.
Boom. Boom. Dropping knowledge on y'all punks.
The very first scene of this movie is lens flare-a-palooza. There are lens flares everywhere in this film. And I will accept Rodrigo's theorem because it's A, cool, and B, actually sounds legit. But I do not believe for a second that all of the lens flares and the light coming through the windowsill with the Venetian blind, I don't believe that is all motivated.
It is possible to overdo lens flares, obviously. I've been watching Fringe recently, J.J. Abrams joint. And that man likes his lens flares. Yeah.
Didn't he shoot with a set of lenses that created lens flares? Like
unnaturally. There are some processes, and this kind of goes back to what we were talking about. All lenses are coated.
Yeah.
With different chemicals to reduce flare, to reduce certain chromatic abrasions, to just generally enhance the picture as it's going or the light as it's going through the lens. You can go through processes where there's a company in California that will modify lenses and remove a lot of that coating so that it adds more lens flare or just adds more flare into the shot. Right. So yeah, there are things that you can do with that. In this case, the lens flares, Matthew, are motivated. So
I don't believe that they all are.
But the lighting... in some cases, Matthew, lens flares are just unavoidable.
Yeah.
This is just the effect of what happens when light enters the lens, and you can't remove them. And so they're just there whether they're motivated or not.
I think there's a lot of stuff in this film. And don't get me wrong, it's visually hypnotic. I got about an hour into this, and I was just like, damn, I can't look away. But, then there are 4 more hours of film to watch, too. So, mm-hmm. There's a point where an entire conversation is taking place heavily shadowed with the light streaming in from outside. And I get that. And then we go outside and we get that, a similar effect or that same effect. And for me, it felt like there was almost a sameness to the fact that almost every single scene had either unusual lighting or the heavy use of the shadow or the lens flare or the streaming light streaming through the Venetian blinds or a very heavy, bright light source just right out of frame so that everything, shadows off to the left. It comes to a point where I'm kind of like, I felt like there was an attempt to really, really... I don't even know
interesting though, because I honestly didn't pay that much attention to each individual instance of lighting. It would be interesting to go back. I mean, Matthew just described like 4 different techniques incidentals basically of that process. So it would be interesting to go back and look for them specifically to see if they actually are motivated. If, you see lens flare when the replicants are around, if you see light through the Venetian blinds only for Decker.
Well, you don't do that. Don't do that necessarily. The lighting is definitely motivated based on time of day and based on the location of where they are in the city. And as you get closer to where Deckard's housing is, a more populated part of the city, there's more light outside that's motivating it. Mm-hmm. A lot of this takes place at night and on very cloudy, overcast days.
Right.
So there's very few times that when the sun is shining through, and the times that it is shining through, it's late in the evening, late in the day.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you are going to get the, as a way to get the lighting that you want, it takes place at that type of the day during right. the golden hour.
Golden
so you're getting those
hour.
Kind of, getting those kinds of effects. When you move to the toy maker's house,
mm-hmm.
then you are more into a more rural area. And so a lot of the lighting is drawn by the patrols and the advertisement balloons that float mm-hmm. through the city with the giant spotlights that swing through mm-hmm. the city, creating specific light effects that way. A lot of it ends up being backlit a lot of the times, which in that case draws out the rain that's constantly falling both mm-hmm. inside and outside of buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a way that's motivated from that standpoint.
I think that a lot of the lighting is just, it's very heavy stylized, but the world of Blade Runner is a very heavy stylized one. And so to not continue to make the outside world influence on all interior scenes where, mm-hmm. all alleys and buildings are just coated with neon signs.
Right.
I mean, that's mm-hmm. going to affect what you're seeing inside your room.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like a lot of the lighting is not just style, but really just world building.
Mm-hmm. The book that I had mentioned that Zach should read is called Future Noir, The Making of Blade Runner by Paul Salmon. This is a book that is fascinating in... I don't think you could get a book like this. He was a writer for a magazine, and they wanted to do an article that showed a true behind the scenes look at the production of a movie from beginning to end, the whole process. And for whatever reason, the studio, Ridley Scott, everybody up and down the line were just like, sure, we'll give you complete access to the entire production of this movie. So this guy was involved during the casting sessions. He was there observing wow. and taking notes. He's got notes on how they originally didn't want Harrison Ford, and then they got mm-hmm. Harrison Ford. He was there for every decision-making meeting, and Ridley Scott was like, sure, sure, come along. This will, you know, could talk to cast and crew at any time.
Wow.
And over the course of the making of this movie, he was writing stuff for Omni Magazine, and he was writing stuff for a couple of other magazines where he was publishing articles. And then finally, after the movie came out, he was able to release, I think in the magazine form, is like 125 pages. Well, 10 years later, or whatever, however many years later, he was like, I've got so many notes, and I've, you know, even that magazine article wasn't complete. And so this book goes through, not in a very dry way, because it's very engaging, but it goes through every single part of the making of this movie, why they did things the way they did, why decisions were made, the problems that they had with cast and crew in brutal detail. I mean, this is stuff that today the studios would be like, no, don't include that. But he's got that kind of access. I guess there was a strike or something going on at one point. It's been about 10 years since I've read this book.
There was a threat of a director's guild strike.
Right.
So they had to make sure to wrap filming before the supposed start date, so they wouldn't lose Ridley off the film.
And so they were going way over hours on stuff. So they were going beyond a normal day is 12 hours. Time and a half is up to 14 hours. And then after that, you're on double time. Mm-hmm. And they were hitting way into double time a lot on this production.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all night, because they were filming at night.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were like eating their lunch at 12:30 in the morning so they could continue filming all through the wee hours.
I like that. Harrison Ford disliked the entire idea of a voiceover from the start, says Katie Haber. He thought it was overkill and it was too over emphatic and disruptive. Ridley wasn't exactly committed to the idea either, except he kept waffling on the narration, partially because he wasn't sure what had been written was strong enough to support the demands placed on it. And so it goes into, you know, the whole discussion of the voiceover. It goes into all the special effects stuff that went on. And if people are really wanting to find a really good... Now, there's a difference between description of how the film was made and an analysis of the film, because there have been analysis left and right on this. But this is, I think, probably the best book I've ever read on the making of any movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's just fantastic. Did you read it, Zach?
I have read a few sections of it. I couldn't read all of it. leading up to the podcast, but I'm going to keep reading it because it's not, like you said, it's not like a textbook. Like,
right, right.
This is what happened this day. It's very engaging, and you get a huge swath of knowledge from everyone involved. Mm-hmm. It's just a really good read.
Mm-hmm. So why don't we have some people that helped make this show possible.
Yeah, we do. Wonderful people, whose names are Terry... Gosh dang it.
I purposely made sure you had the toughest names this week.
I'm sorry, everyone. You're wonderful people.
Oh,
you're allowed to spell and pronounce my name wrong for life. Carte blanche. Terry Ollis, Tan Jingming, Ivan Peterson, Brian Ganninger, Christopher Hudspeth, Matt Lowe, Michelle Nielsen, Daniel Jewison, and Joseph Calarudo.
Careful on that one.
Okay. Thank you for donating to Major Spoilers. You're all wonderful, and thank you for helping keep all of our podcast goodness and sites up and running. You're awesome. Go enjoy VIP land.
We love you.
Oh, yeah, definitely join VIP land. Get in there. Be a part of that. So from the special effects side, the editing side, Zach, mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
I thought the special effects were freaking amazing.
You know, all that's miniatures.
Is it really?
Oh, the whole the Hades landscape that you open up in the beginning with the with the shooting flames and the pyramid, all done in miniature.
Oh, wonderful.
There's a cool process when you're working with miniatures. The first thing is that you usually shoot at a different film speed because you're wanting to make these miniatures look large, and there's actually a formula that you can calculate based on your frame rate to show exactly at what frame rate you should be shooting at so that you could take this normal person who's walking along and make him seem like a giant on the screen just by slowing him down at the proper rate. But the other thing that you do to make miniatures look big is you shoot in a room filled with smoke or fog. Because naturally we have atmospheric haze, and as things get further away, they start to fade in the distance. Well, when you shoot with a miniature, everything's in focus. Yeah. It doesn't happen. So you have to artificially recreate that by filling the room with smoke.
And they've been doing that on Super Sentai for years.
Yeah, and they've been doing this effect for years. I mean, it just didn't start with Blade Runner. I mean, they've been doing this since, go back to the old World War II movies and before, where they've been doing these kinds of things. So, and I would bet Metropolis probably did some of that too. But yeah, using smoke for miniatures is real effective. You can also use smoke to shoot underwater scenes to where you're not actually shooting underwater. It's called shooting... wet for dry or dry for wet, and where it, because of the smoke in the room, the submarine coming at you looks like it's underwater, even though it's really just in a dry floor inside of a studio,
which is pretty awesome.
Very cool.
Yeah. So that's kind of cool about the special effects. So just imagine wiring up the Tyrell Corporation with all these little LED lights and everything inside there.
Awesome.
Getting it. And now you can tell in the original version, the fireballs coming out of the refineries were composited in, and you could see the mat in the VHS release. In this one, you can't see it. I mean,
been some digital touch up.
Well, that's what I was wondering. And I tried to look to see, because when I looked at that opening shot, I was like, has this been recreated in 3D? And I couldn't find anything that says that it had been redone in 3D. So that's how well the tweaking
touch up.
They probably did some tweaking, but cleaning up the movie.
But I think what it is a digital process by which they fix things up, but it's not a like 3D rendering recreation of that shot. I mean, it is just
They digitized the as close to they could as the original media. Right. I'm sure. But, you know, they did that same thing in the closing shots of Orgasmo when they burned down the house belonging to Neutered Man.
Okay.
Noted.
That was a weird sentence.
Yes. Anyway.
It was completely legitimate within the conversation we were having. We were shooting miniatures in a smoky room.
Okay. What else about the special effects did you make note of?
The cars... getting up off the ground.
The spinners.
Couldn't figure out how they did it.
Wires.
Was it? Or
what you do
above?
Is you mount the car on a forklift. And when it rises up, you just raise the forklift and you shoot it from an angle that you don't see.
Yeah, but they
see
didn't do that because you can see the bottom in the cars.
Yeah, yeah. There's one where they're actually lifting it up with cables.
Oh,
so that police one,
yeah,
where it kind of comes up and spins, that's all being lifted up by cables. Okay. And you just have to go in and digitally paint those out.
Yeah, that was good.
You just hook those cables up to a forklift.
The eyes were good.
And then raise the forklift with cables.
Exactly. I didn't even think about that until right now. The eyes. Those had to be...
Which eyes?
The android eyes.
Oh, that's actually just a natural...
Is it just practical? They just put contacts in or something?
No.
No.
No. You ever... Well, maybe not, because maybe he's never taken a picture with film or a flash.
Well, I have.
If you take a picture with a flash and it bounces off the retina just right, your eye lights up red. It's that same process that they're doing here.
So they were just...
They're just reflecting light off the back of somebody's retina, and it's illuminating.
Oh, so they're just directing the light right into their eyes?
Yeah.
I mean, if you remember the owl, the owl just has a light right on it, and it's that same effect. That's why one of its eyes always looks completely white, and then it turns around, and then the other one looks white. It's just bouncing, and owls obviously have a ridiculous amount.
The scariest part of the film for me is when Rachel's hair explodes about 2/3 of the way through, and it's just like she's got huge hair.
Oh yeah. Well, it's very humid. It's very humid in Southern California during the apocalyptic November.
That's how lifelike these replicants are, that it gets a little bit humid and their hair goes crazy.
Yeah, you know how lifelike they are? Leon, the replicant that we first meet. I sit through this movie for an hour and I'm like, who does this guy remind me of?
Well, he's that guy.
Who is this actor? But he's not that guy. He looks just like Daryl from Storage Wars.
And I'm like,
my God, it's Daryl. But yeah, that's a really good replicant job. Clearly, they took his design from ancient reality television series.
Right, right.
Rachel is a composite Kardashian.
Yeah. Yep, and Daryl Hannah is that lady from Splash.
Yeah,
exactly. Deckard is based on the ancient hero Han Solo.
This movie has been super influential.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, God, yes. Multiple media.
You can just see it.
I mean, you just look at this film and you look at, not only are there parodies of, the Spinners and the Flyover Los Angeles, but I mean, people have actually gone in and not lifted elements, but have used that as an influence for what they're doing. And it is referenced in a lot of places. I mean, if you want to find a brilliant reference to Blade Runner, go and look at Batman, the animated series. In the first season of Batman, the animated series, there is a android, Hordak, I think is what the name, Hardak. Hardak is a supercomputer that realizes the best way to make things work is to build replicants of key influential people in the city, including Bruce Wayne, Commissioner Gordon, et cetera, et cetera. And when they go to, when Bruce Wayne, Batman, sorry, spoiler, goes to investigate.
Spoiler alert. He is the knight.
When he goes to investigate the creator of Hardak, it is a, and I forget the professor's name in Batman, the animated series, but it is voiced by the same guy who plays the Toymaker.
Oh, the Toymaker.
Toymaker in this movie.
Sebastian.
And it's a brilliant piece of voice casting, just like when they did Adam West as the Grey Ghost. Brilliant piece of voice casting. But there is so much Blade Runner influence in that, or Philip K. Dick influence into that, that even just that little voice character part ties back into Blade Runner in that way.
Oh. Yeah.
The first thing I thought of, not when reading the book, but watching the movie, was it felt like Cloud Atlas with Neo Soul is really heavily influenced by Blade Runner. Just the turn replicant, but the way Neo Soul looks, and Neo Soul is flooded with water,
right?
But it's always raining in LA,
and it's all neon and dark.
It feels a lot
futuristic.
If you look at a movie like The Fifth Element, which is a lot brighter, there's still, you can see a lot of Blade Runner in that. Any movie that is set in the future.
Blade Runner
100% Star Trek,
but dystopian, but a dystopian,
exactly. Right,
the dystopian crapsack future. And pretty much any comic book made from about 1983 to 1994 that didn't take place in that year has elements of this
type
of thing.
One of the characters in that book will be wearing Deckard's jacket.
Exactly. Yeah. If you Howard Chaykin's American Flag, if you look at the early Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, if you look at Frank Miller's Ronin, holy crap, you can definitely feel the influence, visually speaking, of this and a couple of other movies around the same time. Mm-hmm. But especially you'll see there's one Howard Chaykin series, Twilight, where one of the characters is an old school DC character. And he used to hunt androids, and he's wearing Deckard's coat. That's the visual cue of what you're looking at. He hunts androids, and he's wearing the exact coat that Harrison Ford has in this film. So it's everywhere across all sorts of media.
And, I mean, just to see – really, it's fascinating just look and see how Philip K. Dick, this way-out-there author, really has totally transformed Hollywood – and how we tell sci-fi stories today. I mean, when you look at Total Recall and you're like, that's based on a Philip K. Dick book, or you go and see The Adjustment Bureau and you're like, that's based on a Philip K. Dick book, or you're looking at, not Scanners, but you're looking at that.
And Scanner Dark.
Yeah, and you're like, that's based on a Philip K. Dick book. I mean, they're so, I mean, sci-fi, you just think that that's sci-fi and it's all due to Philip K. Dick. So, you can go get his books in a number of different collections. You might enjoy reading some of his other books if you enjoyed Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep.
And this movie came out like right after he died.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of actually awesome and horrible all at once.
I actually got to see the Philip K. Dick android at the San Diego Comic-Con in 2006. They had him programmed to respond to like 20 different types of questions. So he had some canned responses. And if you go up to him and say, hey, do androids really dream of electric sheep? He would have, instead of just a one or two word response, he had like a 3 minute long description of that.
Nice.
Sadly, Philip K. Dick's head was stolen after the show in transit back to California, back to Hollywood.
Wow.
And they have not found Philip K. Dick's head yet.
Wow.
That which head is fascinating. Came to life and went rogue.
It might have.
Right now under Disneyland with Mark Twain preparing to take over the world from under the Epcot Center.
It was fascinating just how creepy, eerily, oddly accurate that mannequin was that they had at the show.
I wanted to ask it why the porridge bird lays its eggs in the air, but I was afraid.
So Zach, what did you get out of this film and how's it going to influence what you work on next or in the future?
Yeah, definitely. Being very specific on what all is in your frame and making it all not necessarily important, but all in like,
now, so like an attention to detail.
Yeah. Attention to detail. Yeah. There we go. That's better words.
Do you ever look at your class projects now or catch something on cable and just like, how could we think that that was believable?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's like, I don't know of a good example. Hey, we're having a party and it's supposed to be a loud party and there's three people in the room and there's no sound effects, no music to convey that there's more people outside of the frame. It's just three people sitting around going, hey, man, how you doing? Yeah, shall we go home and drive?
This is a great party.
I've done that.
Yeah. I know.
I know. I thought, like, this reference seems very specific to about three projects I did in college.
So what else? What else? Attention to detail, what else?
Lens flare.
No.
Well, lighting.
Yeah, lighting. There it is. Because I think my favorite lighting scene is the two cops looking at the visual recording of the replicant killing the other Blade Runner. I think that just looked like future noir. It looked old noir, but future noir because all the light was like blue and black and white.
Yeah. There's a lot of faces being lit by monitors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of cool lighting throughout the film.
Well, that's what Rodrigo and I were talking about, is it's like you look at Blade Runner and you're just like, wow, this is what happens when people who really understand lighting go to town.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just like, that's one thing that I always pay attention to more than anything is lighting when I watch stuff. But it's something that I wish I was always better at.
Oh, sorry. Just kind of because I was thinking of monitors. Something else that I caught while watching it that you can read into the thing. You watch the scene, the guy asks him questions about a turtle, shoots the guy, right?
Right. Mm.
Any time after that that you see Deckard watching that, it's edited. It's all of the pauses in between are a lot shorter. So you can, you know, talk about the nature of memory and blah, 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 and all that stuff.
Right.
Because basically any time that you see that original scene, it's distorted in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just wanted to throw that out there. We can talk about life.
Also, thing about one of the replicants, same birthday as I do. Not the year, nice. Same date. I think it was Rachel or Pris.
Well, here's a question Roy Batty. That I
have. No, it wasn't Batty. It was one of the ladies.
Pris. I have a question about Pris, this actually. Film.
What is it?
You know what my question is about this film?
No.
What's Did up? They have to pay for all the product placement in this film?
Coke?
Not just Coke. They're not the only logo.
There is actually at one point this belief that there was a Blade Runner curse because so many of the companies that were represented in the movie went bankrupt within like 5 years of the movie being released. Atari, Pan Am, Coca-Cola was going through some stuff.
Because Atari one seems weird. It's like, oh, obviously this is going to be the only video game system ever.
Right. Well, but it does make Blade Runner seem like this alternate reality, right?
Yeah.
Where Atari never went out of business.
Mm-hmm. Atari killed them.
But that's the thing. There was this, at one time, there was this belief that if your company was featured in there that you were going to be out of business, and three companies in a row just boom, boom, boom. And Coke went through a very shaky period.
Right, in the 80s.
In the 80s at the same time with New Coke and everything with that. So there was this firm belief that, oh my God, you know, I don't know if Commodore had a bit in there.
I don't know if they did.
But, you know, they went out of business. Pan Am was out. Atari went out. And there was something else. Do a search for
Cuisinart kept showing up. And
do a search for the Blade Runner curse. And I'm sure you'll find out about that.
But I mean, there are a couple of scenes where the Coca-Cola billboard is center of the focus.
Yeah.
I mean, it is our focal point of a particular sequence.
But they nailed it because that's the way Coke is displayed now. It's just
I'm not saying that it's not.
Maybe it's
my question was whether it was Coca-Cola saying, "Here's some money."
We should do wag the dog.
I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was all product placement. I mean, because really, movies in the 80s. Just are littered with product placement left and right, almost to the point where
almost as much as TV shows now.
Almost as much as Transformers movies.
Yeah. almost as much as that whole episode of Bones that was about, hey, everybody wants to go see Avatar.
One more thing that you learned out of this, or something that you want to apply in the future.
Editing.
Hire James Hong.
Yeah, James Hong before he dies. He's brilliant.
Yet he has always looked the same.
I know, isn't that creepy?
James Hong has always been in Chinatown.
A 50-year-old Chinese guy.
Even in Chinatown, he's old.
And Chinatown was 50 years ago.
Yeah, pretty much.
40.
You know who we're talking about, right? James Hong. He was the eyeball scientist.
Guy.
No, he was the
eyeball scientist.
Yeah.
Post dad.
Recognized him automatically. It looks the same today.
Yep. Also, it's amazing. Also. The guy from Big Trouble in Little China, the big bad there.
Also,
David Lopan.
The Kung Fu Panda's dad.
Yeah, I like him in that.
Yes.
And of course, he was Seinfeld's greatest nemesis in the restaurant episode. Yes. Seinfeld.
Seinfeld.
And then where else has James Hong been?
He
was in what's the ping pong battle movie? Balls of Fury.
Balls of Fury.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Same age.
James
Hong. Something else.
That's very awesome.
Zach might want to take into account. That struck me, and it may just be that I'm a particular person for this, because I'm a huge fan of the film works of Brad Pitt for one reason and one reason only.
Because he's dreaming.
Throughout this whole film, they're like, oh, could Deckard be a replicant? Could Deckard be a replicant? The man is constantly eating and drinking throughout this film. Deckard, like 6 or 7 times, you know, in that opening sequence where he sits down and he's getting ready to eat. All throughout this film, Deckard is, you know, eating something, drinking something, putting something in his mouth to make you think, oh, is he real or is he a replicant that just thinks it needs to keep this up? It was fascinating to me. And I mentioned Brad Pitt because everything I see Brad Pitt in, he's constantly eating. Like, constantly throughout the Ocean's 11 movies, throughout Fight Club, all of these films, Brad Pitt is like obsessed with the business of feeding his face as he's reading his lines.
Well, we talked about giving your actor something to do.
Yeah.
Also, Brad Pitt doesn't eat
and he looks
in between movies. No. So when he's shooting him, yes, he only eats when he's shooting a movie. So
and he just got done doing a really big set of squats and abs, so he's got to put the calories
that's
back
probably,
in.
Yeah.
Final question, Zach. Yep. Did your girlfriend watch the movie with you?
Kinda, but not really. She fell asleep both times I watched it.
All right. Great score, Rodrigo.
I think Zach definitely passes this one. In the past, he has come in and talked too much about the business outside of the movie. I think this one was a good balance of, you know, stuff surrounding the movie, but also techniques involved, as well as themes. I mean, the themes were front and center, which is something that I think sometimes we need to bring up a little bit more. But I mean, and granted, Blade Runner slaps you in the face.
Oh,
with
yeah,
themes.
Yeah. We should do a
this is thematically meaningful.
We should do a bonus track of Blade Runner.
Yeah,
that'd be interesting to sit down and just, you know, nail that one out.
Yeah.
Can I come? Because I have things to say.
Sure.
Yeah, we'll let you know when we're doing that.
Steven's a jerk.
What? I just said we'd let him know when we're doing it.
I think.
But I'm shaking my head. No.
Yeah, I think Zach did well this time around.
Yeah, Thank you. I think what you did on this one was because you knew you were going to be tasked with questions that you went in going, okay, what do I need to know about this?
What are these jerks going to ask me?
You watched the movie, you did your research, you followed up with books. I mean, this is, I don't know, this seems to be one of the first times that it seems like you're really interested in learning about this, about the movie that we're discussing. Eager to jump in on this.
Yeah, I would probably agree to a point in that.
Matthew?
Well, I would say that Zach gets an A for two things. One, Zach realizes that this is a favorite film of the head teacher and made sure that he availed himself of as much information as he could.
Actually, is this one of your favorite films? I have no idea.
It's not one of my favorite films. I think from the influential standpoint, it is a very good film, but it's not one of my favorite films.
Knowing how much Zach read and put into this, I can't help but give him an A because I spent something like 17 hours watching Blade Runner. And I know that he spent at least 10 to 12 more hours reading and figuring out what in God's name the movie was about.
You know, this movie is 40 minutes shorter than the last movie we watched, right?
Zach gets 40 movies. Blade Runner gets a
Mad World.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's... I'm pretty sure the French Revolution was 40 minutes shorter than Mad World.
Yeah. The Mad World's opening thing was, I think, the Bronze Age.
But yeah.
I'm going to give Zach an A because there are things in this movie that just drive me nuts. I will say this. I hated it less than I did in 1983.
All right. Zach.
Great. That'll finish this episode of Zach on Film for this week. Make sure to head over to majorspoilers.com where you can find the podcast posting page and comment to your heart's content about themes and lighting and did you think the movie was too long? Because I didn't. And all of that there. Also head to the main page, majorspoilers.com once again, and click on that amazon.com link and go buy the 30th anniversary Blu-ray collection of Blade Runner, which features every cut of the film possible with bonus features and all sorts of goodies.
About 10 hours worth of stuff.
So much stuff. And you can buy a Blu-ray player to watch that on a big screen TV. None of it will cost you any extra, but a little bit will come back to us to keep this podcasting goodness coming into your ears week after week. That's it for this week. Next week, another movie with an ambiguous ending, Inception. Next week on Zach on Film.
Light that burns twice as bright burns half as long.